This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age, online at reformedforum.org. This is the Reformed Media Review, episode number 49. Today we speak about Tolian Chavijian's new book, Jesus Plus Nothing Equals Everything. It's time for another episode of the Reformed Media Review. My name is Camden Busey. I'm pleased to be back in the studio, but I have a couple friends with me who are not in the studio. Let me introduce to you today our panel. We have Jared Oliphant, who's regional coordinator for Westminster Theological Seminary. He's in Charlotte, just outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back, Jared. It's good to have you on the program again.
Hey, Camden. Great to be here.
Yeah, we're also very pleased to have a special guest today. We're very excited to welcome Pastor Mark Jones. He's the minister at Faith PCA in Vancouver. He's been there since 2007. Welcome to the program, Mark. It's great to have you.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here.
Yeah, we're excited today to be speaking about a few things, but we're going to focus our attention on a new book by Tolian Chavijian, which is titled Jesus Plus Nothing Equals Everything. But before we get to that, I do need to mention, of course, that Reformed Forum in this program, Reformed Media Review, is listener supported. And if you enjoy what we do and would like to see us continue it, please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to help support our work today. There you can easily sign up and pledge your support and help us to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge at Reformed Forum, and this program in particular, Reformed Media Review. Well, guys, especially Jared, we did an episode a week or two ago. We were trying to revive this program, and I've been doing book reviews for Ref 21 now. If we go to reformation21.org, so we're going to try to double these up where we can speak with reviewers of books, as well as publish them in print, online, in various places. So, Mark, you have a review of Tolian Chavijian's book that you've published over at Meet the Puritans. When did that come out? Just a few weeks ago?
Yeah, I think it was a few. I've actually forgotten, but I'm pretty sure it was a few weeks ago. Mm. And I don't even know the date. December 16th, I think.
Wonderful.
Before Christmas.
Yeah.
MeetThePuritans.com. You can visit that website. It's a great resource there. And Jared, you have a review forthcoming for Ref 21, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I hear that, I guess, by the time this airs, it should be within this week. So look out for that. I'm not sure if we'll have a direct link, but should be making the rounds here.
It'll be
soon.
Out there soon. Yeah, you can visit reformation21.org. On the right in the sidebar, you can see a list of recent reviews, so it'll show up there when it's available. Well, guys, we're out to start. I guess I'll pass things to you, Jared. I haven't read the book myself, so I'm going to be the inquisitive outsider asking these two guys about the book as we go through it. So, Jared, I think I'll hand things over to you since you are much more familiar than I on this subject.
Sure. Yeah, I think part of our intention in discussing the book was really because of maybe its exposure. How many people have read it, are talking about it. It's really getting a lot of press out there. I think partially because of just who Tolian is, and he's definitely a public figure out there and has a lot of influence and, you know, pastor down there in Florida. Mm-hmm. And from the title, I mean, it's a title that breeds curiosity. You know, Jesus plus nothing equals everything. How someone unpacks that, I'm sure, is just innately curious. So the press from the book has been interesting. It initially, as I was watching it, it came out as almost nothing but positive. And there was a lot of great things said about the book, and people were still kind of getting curious, so it gained some traction there. And I think at some point, you know, all these things started to converge with the book reviews. Actually, David Murray posted a blog series. I think it was a 3-part series, a review on this book, and obviously pointed out a lot of things that are helpful about the book, but that was the first kind of high-profile review that I saw raising some questions on specifics of the book. And then, you know, I knew that Mark was coming out with his own review on it. And so I think partially the popularity of this book just helps us discuss something that a lot of people are familiar with and maybe help define some terms and get some clarity on issues of salvation, law, gospel, a lot of things that, you know, Camden, we've been talking about for a while,
but
maybe can hone even further using the book as kind of a springboard for that. And especially with Mark and his background, I don't know, Mark, if you want to just let the listeners know a little bit about, you know, what your, I guess, theological expertise is in, kind of what your, where you live in the theological world and in the historical world.
Sure. Well, my I did my PhD on Thomas Goodwin at Leiden University, and it was on his Christology, so mainly in the area of soteriology. And then I kept doing a number of projects on the side in Puritan theology. And so Joel Beakey and I have a pretty substantial work on Puritan theology coming out. I think it's going to be over 1,200 pages.
Wow.
Middle of this year. It's a sort of Puritan systematic theology. And a lot of the issues that you guys discuss and some of the things I brought up in my review are going to be fleshed out in greater detail, like law, gospel, covenant conditions, union with Christ, covenant of works. So that's mainly my area, but I've been trying to move into the 18th century now. I've got a book coming out on debates that are taking place in the 18th century between Reformed theologians. And then, of course, there was a book I edited with Michael Haken called Drawn into Controversy, which is looks at all of the major debates among the Puritans in the 17th century. So that's a little bit of where I'm at right now.
Oh, wow.
Good. Nice. Well, and I guess part two of this kind of introduction is I want to be clear to the listeners. It seems, and this is just anecdotal, it seems that there tends to be some emotion, at points high emotion regarding this book. I don't exactly know why, but people get very intense when it comes to this discussion. And I think I just want to make clear from the outset that we're not here to blast anyone or to criticize an individual just for the individual's sake or anything. We really, at least my focus is on trying to get some categories in order, trying to read discerningly and try to see our way through a lot of the things that have been brought up in the book. And really that's my heart's desire, is really just to gain some clarity on the issues. Mm-hmm. So I hope it's seen that way. I hope that some of the emotion maybe can at least somewhat be put aside in regards to the book, because a lot of people just, I mean, a lot of people love the book. A lot of people feel very personally convicted by it. And maybe we can get into this, but part of that may be prompted by his blog series that he has been, that Tolian has been doing on the Gospel Coalition, that really over the past, I don't know, year plus, maybe 2 years, has ramped up to the book itself, because he mostly talks about these kinds of issues on the blog. I don't know if you guys want to comment on that, but that's at least kind of my take on the history developing to the book.
Well, it seems like that's where a lot of the buzz came from, the blog series, and then the subsequent tweets and that sort of thing. So it's all one lump, you know, it fits in together. So I think that's where a lot of people are coming from, that context, having come to the book knowing a bit about where he stands on a number of systematic issues already because of the blog.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just to put it in context again, maybe Mark, if you want to comment, and this was brought up in your review, if we can go back and situate what discussions are going on in the book, if we can go back and to maybe let the antinomian discussions that were going on that you touch on, this book is part of an ongoing conversation. It's just not coming out of the blue. In one sense, there's not a lot of new stuff here. Certainly it's put in a modern context, so there's some nuance. But what was going on in the antinomian post-reformational discussions that you think might be relevant for framing how we can see the book currently?
Well, That's probably one of the trickiest questions that I've had to face in my research in the last couple of years is the sort of terminology that we use today and how most people understand it. And if you speak to the average sort of churchman and perhaps even pastor about what antinomianism is, they would probably say it's against God's law and those who don't want to keep God's law. And certainly Agricola, in his reaction to Luther's theology, may have been that crass, but the 17th century antinomians, it wasn't so much about were they against God's law or for it. That was certainly an issue, but it was typically revolved around questions of conditions, application. Were works the way to life or were works the way of life? Was faith necessary for justification? Was it antecedent to justification or consequent? It was very intricate. And so when I use the terminology of antinomians and antinomianism, I'm understanding it in the 17th century context and the way it was understood. So that's why I'm a little bit reticent of using it today, because not many go back to the initial context. And so it becomes a pejorative term, as it invariably was back in England. So it's a helpful term if it's understood properly in its context. But what I noticed in, if I may just jump into Tullian's book, was that I think it's clear he would say that we are to keep God's law. I don't read anywhere where he's saying we shouldn't. So that's not the issue. The issue is ways of speaking and some of the ways in which he relates justification and sanctification and some of the ways in which he speaks about grace and law. And I must confess, I haven't been reading much popular literature, but I was put onto some of his blog posts and this book, and what struck me is how similar it sounded to some of the antinomians in the 17th century. And so I thought, well, this seems to be a big issue in the church right now, and I thought I'd write a review of the book, placing it in that context. So I don't know if there's anything you want me to go from there or ask anything, but that's why I wrote the review.
Sure. Okay, well, and maybe we can get some more clarity by bringing in the term and the discussion of grace. What do we mean by grace? We've touched a little bit on law, and what do you see if you were to either define grace or situate grace in the proper context? And I'll sidebar that with, you know, a lot of people will come back with a retort of what you just said, that kind of the antinomian similarities, by saying that either you don't get grace, or, you know, if you say that, then you haven't really plumbed the depth of grace, and grace is so infinite we can't really get our minds around. So there's a lot of that kind of talk. So maybe as we move forward, we can start to define what do we mean by grace when we talk about it, and maybe how does that differ from how grace, scandalous grace, whatever else grace is mentioned in the book? What kind of definition can we come to with grace?
Sure. Well, I think that will be very helpful, because, again, returning to the 17th century, it was fascinating if you read the writings of John Saltmarsh or Tobias Crisp, those types of men who were accused of antinomianism. They would be often saying, we're the true defenders of free grace. And they said, people, if they're going to criticize us for preaching grace, we're going to preach even more grace against that criticism. And so they were actually criticized, the antinomians, by the Westminster Divines. So as someone who's a PCA minister and someone who finds myself in general agreement with their theology, I see that it's possible to have Orthodox theologians criticized for critiquing people who preach free grace. So it's a little bit tricky to criticize somebody who's trying to promote grace, because it looks like you're opposed to it.
Yes.
But if the Westminster Divines felt compelled to oppose these ministers for preaching their view of grace, then I don't think it necessarily means we're anti-grace. I think we all agree that without grace, there is no hope, there's no salvation, and there's no point in really having this discussion. But what I would say is that grace, in at least in classical Reformed Orthodoxy, is not some sort of force or something that is abstracted apart from the person of Christ. And so in our fallen state, grace comes to us, is really Christ coming to us. It's Christ applied to us. It's Christ for us. It's Christ in us. And he does that through means of the Spirit. And that's why the Spirit in the New Covenant takes on the name of Christ in Romans 8 and 1 Peter 1, the Spirit of Christ. So I would never, ever want to speak about grace constantly abstracted from the person and work of Jesus Christ. And I think that's vitally important for how we move forward in this discussion.
Yeah, yeah, that's helpful. And another point I want to talk about when it comes to grace is there's a, it seems as if at times the language is described as grace being really our only motivation that should be at play when we're talking about good works. So there's a quote on page 153 of the book, and it again, I'm taking this out of context, so I acknowledge that, but here's what the quote says. It says, "It is always the gospel of God's free grace that should motivate our right doing. Otherwise, we are nothing better than Pharisees." And you know, I think like in a lot of these types of quotes, we know what maybe he's trying to get at or others are trying to get at. But I wonder, you know, how can we maybe clarify that or turn it, you know, spin it positively or even just, you know, correct it and clarify it. And this, again, is the topic of the motivation of our right doing. We're not as much talking about a definition of grace, but the motivation for, I guess, doing good works.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, if there were just there's sometimes a single word in a sentence that Tullian will write that I think if he just changed that, it would make a huge difference. So let me give two examples off the top of my head. One is sanctification is simply, and the word I'm emphasizing there is simply, the art of getting used to justification. And that's a quote from Lutheran theologian Gerhard O. Ford. And I think sanctification can involve getting used to your justification. Nobody would deny that. The problem is when you make it simply that. And so coming back to his quote that Jared just gave, that it is only the gospel of God's free grace that should motivate us, I would say that you could even say the primary motive is God's free grace and the gospel, but it is not the only motive. I think scripture is quite clear that it's not the only motive. Quite apart from the gospel, there will always be an ontological creator-creature distinction that means we keep God's law simply because of who we are and who God is. And when we look at keeping God's law out of his grace, we must again go back to looking at Christ, who is the author of grace. And grace. And so I keep God's law because of who Christ is, and I fear him and I love him. And I can also say that his love for me is what motivates my obedience. But it is never as simple as just saying that it's the only reason we do so. Again, I think if he would just change or modify words, that would be much more helpful in this discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, again, putting this in context, that motivation is often contrasted with a motivation that Tullian himself kind of confesses prior to this pivotal point of pastoral transition in 2009 with Coral Ridge, that, you know, he admits that he had a problem really taking human opinion too seriously or letting people's thoughts and opinions affect him. And he would be focusing on that as a motivation. And he wanted to get, you know, he saw grace and that kind of freed him from taking too seriously other people's opinions. I think that's a good thing. We don't want to say that, you know, human opinion should motivate our good works, really at all, I guess, in some cases.
What happens when we seem to evacuate grace or the person of Christ from sanctification? We end up with some odd problems, don't we not? I liked, yeah, Mark, earlier what you mentioned about what grace is, and it can never be abstracted. One definition of sanctification I've heard that I've thought is helpful, and I think it fits in very well with the language of the Westminster Standards, is it's the application of Christ's death and resurrection to the believer by the power of the Holy Spirit. And if we think about sanctification as an entire work, there, you know, many of us think there's a definitive aspect, which is the mortification of the old man. It's that union with Christ in his death, in his crucifixion. And then there's this rising to new life, which is involved. And there's the process of ethical transformation that happens, this holiness that is produced in the subjective life of the believer. None of that ever touches the ground of justification. But yet we see that it's related to the full program of salvation, of soteriology, because it's all part of the person and work of Christ being for the sinner. One for his account, you know, forensically, but also one for his state or his condition, I should say, that Christ comes and changes somebody. And that's part of the gospel as well. What do you think about that when we speak about sanctification as just getting used to justification? In my mind, it seems to evacuate grace in a fuller sense from the process of sanctification.
Yeah, well, if we go back to a crucial distinction, and when I studied the Protestant scholastics and the Puritans and Reformed Orthodoxy, I think one of the major contributions they made to the church was the use of distinctions. And Johannes Macopius talks about how a good distinction resolves a lot of theological problems. And the distinction between impetration and application was something that the antinomians sort of blurred. And it's impetration is Christ's work that he did, and then application is the application of that work, and justification is the application of Christ's work. And I think what Tullian sometimes does is makes justification impetration instead of application. And so what you have is sanctification is also application, and justification is application. But you have justification looking to another application. Instead, justification and sanctification both look back to Christ's impetration, which is not synonymous with justification. And, no, and that's no. That's a bit of a I would say it's somewhat confusing in his language. I think I know what he's getting at, but I could, you know, I'd like to clarify it a little more by making that distinction between what's applied from Christ's work.
Mm-hmm. That's more of what Hermann Ritterbos spoke of as the historia salutis and ordo salutis distinction. And I've found that distinction is lacking in other theologians of similar stripe on this subject, that there seems to be just a general confusion or a failure to implement that distinction, which helpfully clarifies many issues. When we do blur the distinction between historia and ordo, we end up with some rather odd formulations that we have to make if we want to make sense of our theology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one reference that's often quoted is the John 19:30 passage when Christ says, "It is finished." And oftentimes this verse is quoted as application to you, which of course you get there, and of course that's involved. But like you just said, there's no recognition that this is something that happens in history, and then the application of that redemption is another distinction that we have to get clear on, and that there are other things involved besides it is finished for you in your own life as a believer at this particular point when you're struggling with sin or something like that.
Yeah, well, I think another thing that struck me in this debate is how phrases sometimes get tossed around and sometimes even passages get used. And I'm not always quite so sure that we've maybe understood the passage correctly. We could look at Romans 6:1 and how does Paul answer the charge of antinomianism? Well, he answers it with more gospel. And I think that's not really sensitive to the context of Romans. And most people don't even know what comes before that in Romans chapter 5 towards the end. And also John 19 that you quoted, it is finished. Well, I don't think it's speaking about Christ's work, because his work of impetration, I guess in the 17th century and 16, a lot of divines actually spoke of Christ's intercession as the means by which justification is applied. And so his work continued. What many argued, in fact, was that 1930 is really Christ's humiliation. His state from humiliation is over and he's moving to a state of exaltation. So, that's just we don't need to belabor the exegetical point, but I think we have to be careful with the text, how we can sometimes use it in a way that isn't so fair to the context.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And just one other quote to kind of, emphasize what we've been saying. There's a quote on page 94 and it says, the gospel in fact transforms us precisely because it's not itself a message about our internal transformation, but about Christ's external substitution. And I bring this up because I guess, Mark, I want you to weigh in on this. When we talk about the gospel, in what sense can we say that at least part of the gospel is about transformation? That maybe it's not all about Christ's external substitution to the exclusion of other things. And again, of course, that's involved. Of course, external substitution is involved. But can we flesh out a little bit beyond while still including the external substitution component?
Sure. I think it's pretty obvious to me, at least. I'll speak as historical theologian before someone who wants to do some exegesis of text, and that the Protestant scholastics and Puritans viewed the gospel as not simply Christ for us. It was Christ for us, but the gospel for them actually commanded as well as promised. And Samuel Rutherford actually says that the gospel commands with an even stronger force than the law, because of the great indicative behind the commands. And so Anthony Burgess is really helpful on this. He talks about the gospel most strictly considered, then he talks about the gospel strictly considered, and then he talks about the gospel just considered. And most strictly considered, it speaks of Christ's works of impetration, his life and death. Strictly considered, the gospel actually involves our faith and repentance. And even Ursinus addresses this question, and he's dealing with the law gospel issue, and he places repentance within the realm of the gospel, which might surprise some people. But then the gospel just basically considered, and I think exegetically, it has to involve sanctification and moral transformation. So when Tullian says the gospel is not primarily about internal transformation, I don't know anyone anywhere in the Reformed tradition who would ever say that it is primarily about that. So I'm not sure if he's reacting to something else in America that I'm unaware of up in Canada. But what I would say is that it does, in fact, involve internal transformation. It has to, because of the nature of what it promises.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And this, it also touches on, and again, we've talked about this, but just emphasizing the kind of hard and fast antithesis between law and gospel that we find in the book. And in your review, you helpfully quote the Confession 19:7, and I'll read it. It says, neither are the aforementioned uses of the law contrary to the grace of the gospel, but do sweetly comply with it. The Spirit of Christ subduing and enabling the will of man to do that freely and cheerfully, which the will of God revealed in the law requireth to be done. And I think that's helpful as at least like a starting point to begin to see the law and gospel as maybe in some contexts, opposed, but not, at a fundamental level, and certainly not the only foundation that we go to when we talk about soteriological issues. I don't know what you also wrote something at Meet the Puritans on law and gospel that's definitely relevant to this, but I resonated with your take on this. If maybe you want to summarize how you see law gospel issues, and maybe again how we can kind of broaden our horizons with law gospel language.
Well, the law gospel issue is it's very similar, of course, to the two kingdoms issue, because the antinomians affirmed a law gospel contrast, and in fact, Samuel Rutherford said that the real issue was over the debate between the law and the gospel. So when you ask Augustine, is he two kingdom? You ask Calvin, is he two kingdom? And you ask Daryl Hart, is he two kingdom? Or anybody else for that matter, we'll all say yes. It's what we mean by those terms. And when it comes to the law gospel distinction, it's crucial that we flesh out what we mean by law and gospel and how they are opposed or how they agree. So, for example, in justification, there's a clear antithesis between the law and the gospel. Any PCA pastor or any Reformed minister would have to affirm that in order to be orthodox. What is sometimes a little bit more tricky is the way the law and the gospel relate to each other in sanctification. And in sanctification, they are friends. They sweetly comply. Anthony Burgess makes the point that the law is actually a means of grace, which some strands in the Reformed tradition out there, that wouldn't sit very well with them. But grace and the law are not opposed in the context of the Christian life. So in Tullian's last post, he says, you know, might as well face it, you're addicted to law. Well, I would wonder how the psalmist in Psalm 119, that would actually be a pretty good description of him, in my view. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that in the context of the Christian life. It's when you're addicted to law as your means of justification that it's a heresy. But it's a question of how do we talk about the law in the context of the Christian life? And I think it's one where we say the law is actually our friend. If I may just make one more comment as a practical pointer, I'm thankful for the law that I'm married and that I actually have exclusive rights to my wife and she has exclusive rights to me. And that's something that I find liberating. And I wish people would sometimes speak more about the positive side of the law and how it is gracious and good and when it's used properly. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, it points out that, there seems to be a somewhat universal diagnosis and then a somewhat universal prescription. And I think what you emphasized earlier is that, you know, if we say maybe that this is the case in some churches, in some strands of churches, and that maybe this prescription applies to some, you know, maybe even most, if we want to use that language. But it does seem to be, you know, I tend myself to read these things and kind of bristle because I just don't see myself included in some of these categories or some of these problems. Granted, I have other problems. There's no doubt about it. Believe me, I have problems. But I don't seem to fit into some of these kinds of structures that are laid out in the book. And I also don't really buy the argument that I'd really see it if I looked further in my own heart or something like that. It seems to be kind of an unfalsifiable theory that, you know, if you you have this problem, whether you know it or not, and if you claim that you don't, then, well, you're just not looking hard enough. No one can oppose that kind of argument. And so it seems kind of as, you know, it's almost, it is worth arguing, but it seems kind of like a trap at times, because you just, you can't say anything that, that opposes this type of structure. So for whatever that's worth.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also important. I've mentioned this to a few people that when public figures write books, and when we make criticisms of individuals, and sometimes the criticisms are sharp, and sometimes they're, you know, sometimes friendly sort of jabs to try and get someone to be a bit more careful, or sometimes to clarify. I think it's important for us to try and speak about the people we're addressing. So, of course, when I write a review of Tullian's book, he knows that it's me who's writing it, and I have to stand by that. But one sort of paragraph that struck me in his latest post talks about, "I'm not surprised when I hear venomous rejoinders to grace," and that he's saddened when the very pack of people that God has unconditionally saved and continues to sustain by his free grace are the very ones who push back most violently against it. Now, I'm not even suggesting that he has me in mind. For all I know, he probably hasn't read the review, and I wrote it mainly for people out there. But I do sometimes question the type of language that's used in these discussions. It can be very forceful, and I almost think that I'm that Pharisee that he's describing when he says, if we make other motivations for gospel obedience, then we're nothing better than a Pharisee. And I'm thinking, well, that's me, because I sometimes speak of other motivations. That was actually at the Westminster Assembly. Again, sorry, I'm always turning back there, but it's fascinating the way in which that issue came up. And the antinomians actually argued that if you obeyed the law for any other reason apart from the grace of God, that you were actually, it was a sign you weren't a Christian. And to me, that was very instructive. It was, I think it was in the session 699 of the minutes. And I actually have the quote here, if you guys are interested in hearing it.
Yeah.
It says, "Neither is it an evidence that a man is under law and not under grace when he refrains from evil and does good, because the law encourages the one and deters from the other. But rather, it's a sign of the power of God's grace in him when his heart is subdued conscientiously to live according to the rule, though in things contrary to the dictates of corrupt nature, from the consideration of God's goodness in rewarding freely those that do well, and of his justice in punishing them that do ill." Now, that was quite long, but what they're saying is that it's actually a sign that you're a Christian when you obey the law because it's the law, and when you obey because God rewards you, as well as the threats that are there for lawbreakers. So that's interesting to me.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think, you know, from my point of view, I just want to ask one more question. It's kind of on the practical end, and I'll begin by just saying, you know, I think what we're getting at, I think what we've been saying accurately represents what Scripture actually teaches. So I don't want to take away from that. But as Mark, you're pastoring people, as you're counseling people and dealing with just the daily, the weekly struggles in your own congregation, what's the cash value of a discussion like this? How has these sanctification issues, these soteriology issues, helped you in just talking to people about their sin, what they're struggling with, and maybe what would the difference be if you had, you know, a structure that isn't what we're advocating here?
Well, for me, the key is that our pneumatology fits our Christology, and because we have a robust Christology in terms of what Christ did and the glories of what he did, our pneumatology must fit that. And so in the new covenant, what Christ is able to do for his people is really the outworking of what he did for his people. And so for me, it's not simply just looking to the cross. I think that's extremely important. And one thing I can say is that I have, since I read Tullian's book, thought more about the need to be looking to the cross. So I'm grateful for that. But I also, in my preaching and counseling, speak about the fact that Christ is in you, the hope of glory, that you are no longer just an individual isolated from, somebody else. You are actually a Christian, and Christ dwells in your heart. And when you look at pornography, you are in some sense subjecting Christ to that. And so that's another realm in which I think our pneumatology is really important. And that's an area where I think if Tullian's book were to grow or be revised, I would like to see a more of a section on pneumatology and the work of the Spirit in the life of the Christian as something forward-looking to what we're going to become and not simply what Christ did for us.
Now, Mark, considering the intended audience for this book, and if there's some interest from our listeners, if people wanted to follow up and read more in this space, what are some other books, similar type books on the subject? For one, I'm thinking immediately of Sinclair Ferguson's The Christian Life, which I think is a great, helpful book that seems to be aimed at this similar type audience. Are there any other books you might suggest, or even Puritan works that you might point people to who want to go further and beyond Jesus plus nothing equals everything?
Yeah, I think the book that had the biggest influence on me, and the reason I did my PhD on Goodwin, was his two books that were actually published during his lifetime. One's called Christ Set Forth, and then after that is The Heart of Christ in Heaven Towards Sinners on Earth, and they go hand in hand together. And Christian Focus have actually done a reprint in modern English, which I was part of, and Reformation Heritage Books are selling it for $10, and I think that book will really transform the way many people understand Christ and think about the Christian life. So that would be my choice for a book to read that's discusses these issues. There's many more, but that would be my pick.
Sure. Oh, that sounds excellent. Jared, do you have any other thoughts or suggestions as we wrap up? And or if there's anything that we didn't mention, of course, speak up now. Are there any topics or questions that I failed to ask or we didn't treat?
No, not from my end. I mean, what floods my mind right now are all the discussions that have gone on really within the past like couple years on various sites and various books. You know, there's a book on sanctification that I think Ferguson contributed to, and his work is helpful there.
That's where that Ford quote comes from. Forda.
Yeah.
That same book. It's like five views on sanctification or four views. I forget how many are in there, but that's one of them.
Yeah, yeah. And, this was this had a lot of press. Actually, I guess it was like a year ago. Maybe it was last summer. I forget when. But Kevin DeYoung and Tullian were discussing this issue, and it was very helpful, and it was a very cordial discussion. So there's just a lot of – we won't be able to put everything in like the show notes. And a quick, Google search on this type of issue will produce a lot of results. But would just encourage the listeners to kind of keep informed about these kinds of issues, really from all sides, and let us know maybe where we can be helpful. If we've missed something, if we need to consider something, we always take that seriously. I think, Camden, you can attest to that. So I just appreciate having the discussion, especially with Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark. This is great, and I really appreciate your perspective on things, and especially the depth of study you've done and beyond our own century. It's certainly helpful, and we see that that these things are not new, that these theological issues have happened many, many times before, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think that's one thing I'm trying to help in the discussion, is bring some historical context to some of the things that are being said and not being said, and my hope is that moving forward we can keep these discussions going. And I think whether it's Michael Horton on Union with Christ or continuing, I'd like, it would be a great privilege, and I would love to talk to Horton about these types of issues himself, because, you know, my final comment would be that you can see that Tullian is clearly indebted to Michael Horton and his work. And so I would be curious to sort of get Horton's perspective on this work and where he sees some of its strengths and shortcomings and have that conversation, but maybe sometime in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, we're definitely preparing a bunch of follow-ups now that you've brought up that other thread, and then the discussion on union with Christ, which is very much related because it often focuses on the relationship of justification to the concept of union with Christ. It's all bound up, and we're working hard here at Reformed Forum to provide more follow-ups to that recent exchange between Lane Tipton and Dr. Michael Horton. So we got a lot coming up. So thanks so much for participating, Mark, and for providing your input. I do want to mention that Jared's review should be available shortly at reformation21.org. It might be available by the time this posts. But you can also read Mark's interview at meetthepuritans.com. We'll put a link in the show notes to make it available to all. And, of course, check out the book, Jesus Plus Nothing Equals Everything, written by Tullian Chivijan. Certainly one to think over. And you can visit us online if you'd like to provide us feedback. You can email us at mail@reformedforum.org. You can tweet us at Reformed Forum, or just visit us online at reformedforum.org. You'll find information about all of our programs. I've finally completed moving all of our websites over to a similar look and feel, so everything's been revamped. And please provide feedback. Help us to make the websites better and to provide more Reformed resources to help serve you better and to serve the church better as well. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again on Reformed Media Review. But until that time, tola lege, pick up and read.